Content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from The Week magazine. Today's program is generously underwritten by W.G. Alexander. At W.G. Alexander & Associates, they take pride in providing clients with the best legal counsel by concentrating on elder law, asset protection, and estate planning. They can be contacted at 919-256-7000. We're reading this week from the October 15th, 2021 issue of The Week magazine. The cover drawing this week shows Senators Joe Manchin of West Virginia and Kyrsten Sinema from Arizona. They have been in the spotlight recently. They're both wearing protective vests, reflective vests, like highway workers. Joe Manchin has his hand out in a stop signal. Senator Sinema has her arms folded. Behind them are road blockades and a detour sign. The headline is, "Not So Fast. Will Democratic Centrist Sinema and Manchin Block Biden's Social Spending?" And that is our first main story. We'll start there. The Democrats' internal fight over social spending. What happened? Democrats tried to negotiate a path forward this week for President Biden's $3.5 trillion social spending bill, working toward a scaled-down package that can win the backing of both the party's progressive wing and Senate centrist Kyrsten Sinema of Arizona and Joe Manchin of West Virginia. An inter-party rift over the size of the Build Back Better Act, also called the Human Infrastructure Bill, led House progressives to block a vote on a second traditional infrastructure bill with bipartisan support, which would spend $1.2 trillion on rebuilding roads, bridges, and public transit. The progressives are demanding that the Build Back Better Act pass first so that they do not lose their leverage over Sinema and Manchin, who strongly support the smaller infrastructure bill but want the social spending bill pared way back. The sweeping human infrastructure package would expand Medicare to include vision, hearing, and dental coverage, provide funding for daycare and universal pre-K, allow Medicare to negotiate prescription drug prices, invest in clean energy, and extend to 2025 the child tax credits for low-income and middle-class families that were in this year's COVID relief plan. It would seek to pay for the new benefits through tax increases on corporations and the wealthy. Acknowledging an impasse, Biden put a hold on both bills and agreed to a two-track process, trying an infrastructure vote to passage of the larger bill, tying an infrastructure vote to passage of the larger bill. His concession to progressives angered moderates, but House progressives said they were salvaging Biden's legislative ambitions. "If we pass the infrastructure bill alone, we are not even accomplishing 10% of his agenda," said Representative Ihan Omar of Minnesota. The progressives now face hard choices about how to scale back the sprawling bill. Manchin has floated a $1.5 trillion ceiling, a figure that is not going to happen, said Congressional Progressive Caucus Leader Representative Pramila Jayapal, Democrat from Washington. In a meeting with progressives, Biden told them to expect a bill between $1.9 trillion and $2.2 trillion. A key point of debate was whether to cut some initiatives entirely or to maintain broader provisions by letting them expire sooner or limiting their scope, such as through means testing for benefits such as free community college. "Nobody is going to get everything they want," said Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer. Biden vowed to get both bills across the finish line. "It doesn't matter whether it's in 6 minutes, 6 days, or 6 weeks," he said. "We're going to get it done." What the editorial said: even with a slimmed down bill, Democrats have a chance to implement sweeping historical changes, said USA Today. They can help rescue the climate, cut child poverty, and improve the lives of lower-income and middle-class Americans. They can't blow this landmark opportunity by squabbling and letting the perfect become the enemy of the good. The Democratic Party's hubristic left needs to face reality, said the Chicago Tribune. With the slimmest grip on both the House and Senate, they and Biden want to enact historic social legislation on the scale of FDR's New Deal and LBJ's Great Society, but without those presidents' decisive mandates and large majorities. Last year's election results show voters want a disavowal of ideological extremism on both sides, not a socialist America where high earners are robbed of the fruits of their labors. What the columnist said, Sinema and Manchin are often called moderates, but they're the real extremists, said Kate Aronoff in NewRepublic.com. They are standing in the way of a bill whose provisions enjoy wide public support. The climate measures are a case in point. In what universe is it moderate to block modest spending to speed the transition to green energy at a time when Americans are already being battered by wildfires, drought, excessive heat, and more powerful storms? While Democrats horse trade, those who believe in fiscal and personal responsibility have already lost, said Nolan Finley in the Detroit News. The social spending plan would accelerate America's transformation into a European-style socialist welfare state with free elder care and state-funded preschool. Liberals claim the cost will be covered simply by making the wealthy and corporations pay their fair share. But we'll all pay a steep price when the burden on investors and job creators stalls the economy. To get their social spending bill passed, Biden and the Democrats need to make hard spending choices, said John Cassidy in NewYorker.com. Rather than squeeze as many programs as possible into a reduced bill and rely on accounting ploys, Biden should focus on addressing climate change, raising taxes on corporations and the wealthy, and strengthening working families with subsidized child care. Biden has taken a gamble, said Jonathan Wiseman and Jonathan Martin in the New York Times. He had a bird in hand with the popular bipartisan infrastructure bill, but gave it up to rescue his ambitious spending bill. Now we'll see whether that big bet will pay off, or if we'll be left with a protracted standoff or nothing at all. The outcome could determine Democrats' fate in the midterms and the success of his presidency. Controversy of the week. Facebook. Is it time for Congress to act? Finally, she has a name, said Parmi Olson in Bloomberg.com. Frances Haugen, 37, this week outed herself as the former employee whose leak of reams of internal documents could turn out to be the most important act in Facebook's corporate history. In a 60 Minutes interview followed by televised Senate testimony, Haugen, an algorithm specialist with a Harvard MBA, confirmed what many long suspected but couldn't prove, that Mark Zuckerberg's trillion-dollar company knows its products cause immense social harm. Facebook's own research revealed that its popular Instagram photo-sharing platform has a devastating impact on the mental health of teenage girls. After Facebook adopted a 2018 algorithm tweak designed to increase adult users' engagement with the site, and thus its advertising revenue, Housen says it quickly learned that it's easier to inspire people to anger than it is to other emotions. The result was the torrent of inflammatory misinformation and conspiracy theories that has so divided our society, said Aaron Mack in Slate.com. Ironically, though, this week's Senate hearing had a strikingly bipartisan tone, with Republicans and Democrats agreeing that this is a real issue that Congress should do something about. The question now is what? Hogan herself doesn't have the solution, said Allie Breland in MotherJones.com. She suggested that Congress could set up a federal agency, staffed by former employees like herself, to review Facebook's algorithms and its content, a proposal so unlikely to produce fundamental reform that it may as well have come from Facebook's own lobbyists. New privacy laws that forbade Facebook's massive harvesting of users' data to facilitate manipulating them would be a start. Breaking up the company should also be on the table. Facebook isn't just another greedy U.S. company that regulators need to rein in, said Adrienne LaFrance in TheAtlantic.com. The impact of this global monopoly on our society has been so devastating and so intentional that Congress should consider Facebook a hostile foreign power and act accordingly. So should all of us. Let's take a breath, said Alex Beam in BostonGlobe.com. The fact that Facebook commissioned research into the harmful effects of its algorithms suggests a good faith effort to assess costs and benefits. Hogan's documents also show that Zuckerberg planned to have Facebook lead the charge to vaccinate the world against COVID-19 before anti-vaxxer trolls overran his platform with misinformation. The documents also reveal why Facebook has been frantically tweaking its algorithms, said Robbie Suave in Reason.com. For all his success, Zuckerberg knows he's fighting a losing battle to stay culturally relevant as young people shun Facebook for shiny new platforms like Snapchat and TikTok. Government force is absolutely not necessary to constrain a company already in decline. We can't wait years for Facebook to fade, said Eugene Robinson in the Washington Post. Hogan said that before the 2020 election, Facebook did tighten its policies against incendiary political misinformation, but only briefly. Congress should require the company to make its algorithms public and transparent, so we all know what it's feeding us. Facebook's domination isn't inevitable, said Christine Imba in WashingtonPost.com. The tobacco giants once had more than 42% of Americans addicted to cigarettes, but that began to change when whistleblowers leaked internal research. It is now evident that the harms of Facebook have begun to outweigh the benefits of whatever it's selling. It was a good week for Beaming Up, with the announcement that Star Trek icon William Shatner, 90, would fly to the edge of space on October 12th aboard Jeff Bezos' Blue Origin spacecraft. I've heard about space for a long time now, said Shatner. I'm taking the opportunity to see it for myself. What a miracle. It was a good week for coming out as non-binary. After Andrew Yang, former candidate for president and New York City mayor, announced he is leaving the Democratic Party and rebranding as an independent. Polarization, Yang said, is getting worse than ever. It was a good week for due diligence after a Maryland couple bought a bungalow in Cottage City, Maryland at a bargain price and then discovered it's the site of the demonic possession that inspired the 1973 horror classic The Exorcist. The first thing I thought was, oh, God, this is going to tank our resale value, said homeowner Danielle Witt. But it was a bad week for crossing the line after members of a progressive organization followed Senator Kyrsten Sinema into an Arizona bathroom stall, berated her for blocking the Democrats' human infrastructure bill, and then proudly released a video of the ambush. It was a bad week for attention whores after Donald Trump asked a federal judge to restore his Twitter account as clicks on stories about him continued to decline, dropping another 37% in August and September. And finally, it was a bad week for kids today after a Wall Street Journal report that old school mafiosi are complaining that younger mobsters are soft and spend too much time texting. Everything is on the phones with them, said a former member of the Colombo crime family. The briefing this week is Iran's revived nuclear program. Iran is closer to a bomb than ever before. Is a new nuclear deal possible? What is Iran's nuclear status? Iran doesn't have nukes yet, but it is close to being able to build them. Since the Trump administration withdrew in 2018 from the 2015 nuclear deal, which brought UN nuclear inspections in exchange for sanctions relief, Iran has drastically increased the pace of its pursuit. It is currently about a month away from producing enough fuel for a weapon, although constructing a warhead and mounting it on a missile would take much longer. Some experts believe the country may be trying to become a threshold state, able to build nukes whenever it decides to go all out, while others think it is merely seeking leverage in negotiations to force the U.S. to return to the deal and lift sanctions. The original pact between Iran and a group of world powers restricted Iran to enriching uranium to just 4% potency, enough to run a nuclear power plant, but far from the 90% required for a bomb. Now it has reportedly reached 60%, even as President Ibrahim Raisi says his administration is willing to negotiate. Who is Raisi? Raisi, 60, is an ultra-conservative protege of 82-year-old Ayatollah Ali Khamenei and a top candidate to succeed him as supreme leader. His black turban signals that he is a descendant of the Prophet Muhammad, a student protester when the Islamic Revolution broke out in 1979. He rose quickly to become a Tehran prosecutor and served on one of the four-judge panels known as death committees that retired several thousand dissident prisoners and condemned them to execution. Raisi took office in August after a low-turnout election, heavily rigged in his favor, in which reformist candidates were barred from running. He immediately took a tough line against the U.S., saying at the U.N. last month that the U.S. hegemonic system has no credibility and that U.S. sanctions against Iran amount to crimes against humanity. What are the sanctions? The U.S. has laid various economic sanctions on Iran since 1979, when Islamic radical students overthrew the U.S.-supported Shah and took U.S. embassy workers hostage. At that time, the U.S. froze $12 billion in Iranian assets. Over the years, the sanctions have been increased many times by both the U.S. and the U.N. Security Council to punish Tehran for pursuing nuclear weapons technology. And by the 2010s, the Iranian economy was suffering severely. In 2015, desperate to get an international ban on selling Iranian oil lifted, the administration of President Hassan Rouhani clinched the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, JCPOA, with the Obama administration, as well as the UK, France, Russia, China, and Germany. American conservatives denounced the deal as too lenient, and even though UN inspectors confirmed that Iran was complying, then President Trump unilaterally pulled the U.S. out of the six-party pact and imposed the most debilitating sanctions yet in a maximum pressure policy. In just 2 years, Iran's inflation rate soared to 40% and the poverty rate doubled to 30%. What effect did that have? It actually strengthened the power of the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, a military body that answers directly to the supreme leader and has championed the nuclear program. The Revolutionary Guard has clashed with Iran's pro-democracy reformers for decades, but the reformers have had enough popular support to win parliament seats and even the presidency, acting as a check on the supreme leader's extremism. Trump's sanctions undermined the reformers by proving that the U.S. was not a reliable negotiator and by making Iran desperate for international financial outlets. Through its front companies, the Revolutionary Guard bought up financial and oil contracts that were used to evade sanctions. The Guard then controlled Iran's ability to sell oil under the table, enhancing its own power and status. That paved the way for anti-U.S. hardliner Raisi to take the presidency. What has Biden done? President Biden is seeking to revive the agreement, promising full compliance from the U.S. if Iran does the same. But he's also ratcheted up the pressure by imposing new restrictions, blocking Iran from using its assets held in South Korean and Japanese banks to buy COVID vaccines, and pressuring the U.K. to halt repayment of old Iranian debt. At this point, the Iranians no longer trust America's word, and the chaotic pullout from Afghanistan damaged the U.S.'s image as a nation whose military might is to be feared, and created doubt about its willingness to intervene abroad. What's the next step? Raisi insists that Iran will resume multinational nuclear talks in Vienna soon, but has not given a date. Yet with every passing month, the country gets closer to achieving breakout capability. Some believe Tehran is just stalling until it's capable of building a bomb. We really don't have the level of deterrence we need, whether on the nuclear issue or in the region, U.S. diplomat Dennis Ross told Foreign Policy. The Iranians are clearly not afraid of us any longer. Time for a few of the best columns, starting with, how far right will Supremes go this term? Supreme Court conservatives are embracing the kind of judicial activism conservatives once fought against, said Donald Ayer. As the 2021-22 term begins with abortion, gun rights, religious freedom, and other explosive issues on the docket, the court's majority seems ready to cast aside long-established precedents to significantly reshape the law. Last term, its six Republican-appointed justices oversaw a number of radical departures from precedent on issues such as voting rights, union organizing, and religious exemptions from public health rules and discrimination laws. Recently, the court conspicuously twiddled its thumbs as Texas enacted an abortion law that deliberately flouts Roe v. Wade, suggesting a majority could overturn Roe altogether in an upcoming case on Mississippi's law banning abortion after 15 weeks. When I was part of the Reagan administration's Justice Department, we sought to correct the judicial meddling of the liberal Warren Court. But now court conservatives seem eager to throw out decades of settled precedent. No wonder that a recent poll found public approval of the court had plummeted to 40%. If justices consistently render decisions that one party wants, Americans will see them as partisans in robes, and they will be right. How to help Trump return to power? If Joe Biden and the Democrats can't stop the mounting influx of migrants at the southern border, said Andrew Sullivan, Donald Trump may win the 2024 election in a romp. The hard reality is that the cold civil war now raging in this country is fueled by rapidly changing demographics, with the percentage of foreign-born people in the U.S. now higher than at any time in a century. More than 1 million migrants were intercepted at the border in the first 6 months of the year, including people from Haiti, Venezuela, Cuba, and Romania. You need not be a white supremacist touting replacement theory to believe that enforcing borders is a core function of any government. Biden is in a terrible spot with a broken immigration system and far too immigration courts, judges, and detention centers. But Biden made a major mistake when he ended Trump's Remain in Mexico policy and began admitting thousands of migrants while they await asylum hearings. That told legions of desperate people it was worth traveling hundreds of miles to try their chances at the border. If Biden doesn't get control of the chaos, it may enable an unhinged authoritarian to return to power. This is an international column. Pandora Papers, exposing world leaders' hidden fortunes. The biggest leak of offshore financial data in history has exposed the secret deals and hidden assets of some of the world's richest and most powerful people, said Simon Goodley in The Guardian. The Pandora Papers, a trove of 11.9 million files from 14 legal and financial services firms operating in the British Virgin Islands, Panama, Belize, and elsewhere, show how 35 current and former world leaders and hundreds of public officials in more than 90 countries have hidden billions of dollars from the public and from tax authorities. They include King Abdullah II of Jordan, who has secretly built a $100 million property empire spanning Malibu, Washington, and London. Czech Prime Minister Andrej Babiš, up for re-election this week, is facing questions over why he used a Panamanian investment company to buy a $22 million chateau in the south of France in 2009. Numerous close associates of Russian President Vladimir Putin, including a suspected former girlfriend, appear in the documents. In most cases, the arrangements aren't illegal. They are just not transparent. So voters have no idea what conflicts of interest their leaders may be hiding. The Pandora Papers are an especially embarrassing blow to King Abdullah, said Haaretz. The Jordanian king has tried to portray himself as the devoted father of a struggling nation, which now has a 25% unemployment rate. But the leaked documents reveal that even as he was asking Jordanians to embrace austerity and for the World Bank to provide more economic aid, Abdullah was using shell companies to snap up luxury homes. Among them is a $23 million California Ocean View property, bought in 2017 through a British Virgin Islands firm. Abdullah has done his best to hide these revelations. The website of the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists, a group of 150 media outlets in 117 countries that examine the papers, has been blocked in Jordan, and local media has made no mention of the scandal. At least 19 Russians are named in the data dump, said Vladimir Vasilev. They include Peter Kolbin, a childhood friend of Putin who the U.S. claims is holding hundreds of millions of dollars for the president. The Kremlin has shrugged off the report, saying the reliability of the information is questionable. Ignoring the allegations isn't an option for most of the politicians named, said Jam Martinez Arens and Javier Lafuente in El País from Spain. The revelations are particularly earth-shattering in Latin America, where about $40 billion a year flows to tax havens. Three sitting heads of state, Chile's Sebastián Piñera, Ecuador's Guillermo Lasso, and the Dominican Republic's Luis Abinader, appear in the Pandora Papers, as do 11 former presidents, along with Brazil's current economy minister and the president of its central bank. Too many members of the elite keep a substantial portion of their assets from public scrutiny. It's time to let in the light, and over the next few months, the details will all come out. The last word, our in-depth article, is titled Drinking Alone. For centuries, Americans have used alcohol to enliven social gatherings, said journalist Kate Julian in The Atlantic. But now we're increasingly drinking to numb our anxiety and loneliness, often without joy or company. Few things are more American than drinking heavily, but worrying about how heavily other Americans are drinking is one of them. The Mayflower landed at Plymouth Rock because the crew feared the Pilgrims were going through their beer too quickly. The ship had been headed for the mouth of the Hudson River until its sailors, who, like most Europeans at that time, preferred beer to water, panicked at the possibility of running out before they got home and threatened mutiny. And so the Pilgrims were kicked ashore, short of their intended destination and beerless. Before long, they were not only making their own beer, but also importing wine and liquor. Still within a couple of generations, Puritans like Cotton Mather were warning that a flood of rum could overwhelm all the good order among us. George Washington first won elected office in 1758 by getting voters soused. He is said to have given them 144 gallons of alcohol, enough to win him 307 votes and a seat in Virginia's House of Burgesses. He used the same tactic to keep his troops happy and later became one of the country's leading whiskey distillers. But he nonetheless took to moralizing when it came to other people's drinking, which in 1789 he called the ruin of half the workmen in this country. Hypocritical though he was, Washington had a point. The new country was on a bender, and its drinking would only increase in the years that followed. By 1830, the average American adult was consuming about three times the amount we drink today. An obsession with alcohol's harms understandably followed, starting the country on the long road to prohibition. What's distinctly American about this story is not alcohol's prominent place in our history. That's true of many societies, but the zeal with which we've swung between extremes. Americans tend to drink in more dysfunctional ways than people in other societies, only to become judgmental about nearly any drinking at all. Again and again, an era of overindulgence begets an era of renunciation. Binge, abstain, binge, abstain. Right now, we are lurching into another of our periodic crises over drinking, and both tendencies are on display at once. Since the turn of the millennium, alcohol consumption has risen steadily, in a reversal of its long decline throughout the 1980s and 90s. Before the pandemic, some aspects of the shift seemed sort of fun, as long as you didn't think about them too hard. In the 20th century, you might have been able to buy wine at the supermarket, but you couldn't drink it in the supermarket. Now some grocery stores have wine bars, beer on tap, signs inviting you to shop and sip, and carts with cup holders. Actual bars have decreased in number, but drinking is acceptable in all sorts of other places it didn't used to be. Salons and boutiques dole out cheap cava in plastic cups. Movie theaters serve alcohol. Starbucks serves alcohol. Zoos serve alcohol. Moms carry coffee mugs that say things like, "This might be wine," though for discreet day drinking, the better move might be one of the new hard seltzers, a watered-down malt liquor dressed up for precisely this purpose as a natural soda. Even before COVID-19 arrived on our shores, the consequences of all this were catching up with us. From 1999 to 2017, the number of alcohol-related deaths in the U.S. doubled to more than 70,000 a year, making alcohol one of the leading drivers of the decline in American life expectancy. These numbers are likely to get worse. During the pandemic, the frequency of drinking rose, as did sales of hard liquor. By this February, nearly a quarter of Americans said they'd drunk more over the past year as a means of coping with stress. Explaining these trends is hard. They defy so many recent expectations. Not long ago, millennials were touted as the driest generation. They didn't drink much as teenagers. They were sober curious. They were so admirably focused on being well. And yet here they are day drinking White Claw and dying of cirrhosis at record rates. Media coverage, meanwhile, has swung from overselling the now disputed health benefits of wine to screeching that no amount of alcohol is safe, ever. It might give you cancer, and it will certainly make you die before your time. What most of us want to know coming out of the pandemic is this: am I drinking too much? And how much are other people drinking? And is alcohol actually that bad? For the past 25 years, archaeologists have been working to uncover the ruins of Göbekli Tepe, a temple in the eastern Turkey. It dates to about 10,000 BC, making it about twice as old as Stonehenge. It is made of enormous slabs of rock that would have required hundreds of people to haul from a nearby quarry. As far as archaeologists can tell, no one lived there. No one farmed there. What people did there was party. The remains of what appear to be brewing vats, combined with images of festivals and dancing, suggest that people were gathering in groups, fermenting grain or grapes, writes Edward Sligerland in Drunk, How We Sipped, Danced, and Stumbled Our Way to Civilization, and then getting truly hammered. Over time, groups that drank together would have cohered and flourished, dominating smaller groups, much like the ones, says Slingerland, that prayed together. Moments of slightly buzzed creativity and subsequent innovation might have given them further advantage still. But this rosy story about how alcohol made more friendships and advanced civilization comes with two enormous asterisks. All of that was before the advent of liquor, and before humans started regularly drinking alone. Distilled alcohol is recent. It became widespread in China in the 13th century and in Europe from the 16th to the 18th centuries. As the Industrial Revolution raged, alcohol use became less leisurely. Drinking establishments suddenly started to feature the long counters that we associate with the word bar today, enabling people to drink on the go, rather than around a table with other drinkers. This short move across the barroom reflects a fairly dramatic break from tradition. According to anthropologists, in nearly every era in society, solitary drinking had been almost unheard of among humans. Americans may not have invented binge drinking, but we have a solid claim to binging alone, which was almost unheard of in the old world. During the early 19th century, solitary binges became common enough to need a name, so Americans started calling them sprees or frolics, words that sound a lot happier than the lonely 1 to 3 day benders they described. In his 1979 history, The Alcoholic Republic, the historian W.J. Rohrabaugh calculated the stunning amount of alcohol early Americans drank on a daily basis. In 1830, the average adult was going through more than 9 gallons of spirits each year. Most of this was in the form of whiskey, which, thanks to grain surpluses, was sometimes cheaper than milk. And most of it was drunk at home. And this came on top of early Americans' other favorite drink, homemade cider. Many people, including children, drank cider at every meal. A family could easily go through a barrel a week. Rohrabaugh argued that this longing for oblivion resulted from America's almost unprecedented pace of change between 1790 and 1830. Thanks to rapid westward migration in the years before railroads, canals, and steamboats, he wrote, more Americans lived in isolation and independence than ever before or since. The resulting epidemics of loneliness and anxiety, he concluded, led people to numb their pain with alcohol. The temperance movement that took off in the decades that followed was a more rational response to all of this than it tends to look like in the rearview mirror. However, temperance and prohibition, which went into effect in 1920, cleaved the country into tipplers and teetotalers. Drinkers were on average more educated and more affluent than non-drinkers, and also more likely to live in cities or on the coasts. Dry America, meanwhile, was more rural, more southern, more Midwestern, more church-going, and less educated. After Prohibition's repeal, the alcohol industry refrained from aggressive marketing, especially of liquor. Nonetheless, drinking steadily ticked back up, hitting pre-Prohibition levels in the early 1970s, then surging past them. It peaked in 1981, at which point, true to form, the country took a long look at the empty beer cans littering the lawn and collectively recoiled. What followed has been described as an age of neo-temperance. Taxes on alcohol increased. Warning labels were added to containers. The drinking age went back up to 21. And penalties for drunk driving finally got serious. And then began the current lurch upward. Around the turn of the millennium, Americans said, to hell with it, and poured a second drink. And in almost every year since, we've drunk a bit more wine and a bit more liquor than the year before. But why? One answer is that we did what the alcohol industry was spending billions of dollars persuading us to do. In the 90s, makers of distilled liquor ended their self-imposed ban on TV advertising. They also developed new products that might initiate non-drinkers. Think sweet pre-mixed drinks like Smirnoff Ice and Mike's Hard Lemonade. But this doesn't explain why Americans have been so receptive to the sales pitches. Some people have argued that our increased consumption is a response to various stressors that emerged over this period. This seems closer to the truth. It also may help explain why women account for such a disproportionate share of the recent increase in drinking. In the 2013 book, Her Best Kept Secret, an exploration of the surge in female drinking, the journalist Gabrielle Glaser recalls noticing, early in this century, that women around her were drinking more. Alcohol hadn't been a big part of mom culture in the 90s, when her first daughter was young, but by the time her younger children entered school, it was everywhere. A growing class of merchandise now helps women carry concealed alcohol. There are purses with secret pockets and chunky bracelets that double as flasks, and perhaps the least likely of all to invite close investigation, flasks designed to look like tampons. Almost all of the heavy drinking women Glaser interviewed drank alone. The bottle of wine while cooking, the Baileys in the morning coffee, the Poland Spring bottle secretly filled with vodka. They did so not to feel good, but to take the edge off feeling bad. Men still drink more than women, and of course, no demographic group has a monopoly on either problem drinking or the stresses that can cause it. The shift in women's drinking is particularly stark, but unhealthier forms of alcohol use appear to be proliferating in many groups. Even drinking in bars has become less social in recent years, or at least this was a common perception among about 36 bartenders I surveyed while reporting this article. I have a few regulars who play games on their phone, one in San Francisco said, and I have a standing order to just refill their beer when it's empty. No eye contact or talking until they are ready to leave. Striking up conversations with strangers has become almost taboo, many bartenders observed, especially among younger patrons. So why not just drink at home? Spending money to sit in a bar alone and not talk to anyone was, a bartender in Columbus, Ohio, said, an interesting case of trying to avoid loneliness without actual togetherness. As the pandemic eases, we may be nearing an inflection point. My inner optimist imagines a new world in which Reminded of how much we miss joy and fun in other people, we embrace all kinds of socially connecting activities, including eating and drinking together, while also forswearing unhealthy habits we may have acquired in isolation. But my inner pessimist sees alcohol use continuing in its pandemic vein, more about coping than conviviality. Not all social drinking is good, of course. Maybe some of it should wane, too. For example, some employers have recently banned alcohol from work events because of concerns about its role in unwanted sexual advances and worse. And yet, if we use alcohol more and more as a private drug, we'll enjoy fewer of its social benefits and get a bigger helping of its harms. This was adapted from a story that originally appeared in The Atlantic. Here's a technology article. Siri, will Apple ever really understand us? Happy birthday to Siri, said William Gallagher and AppleInsider.com. As of this month, Apple's voice assistant has been listening to us and frustrating us for a decade. When Apple unveiled Siri in October 2011, executives bragged that they'd turned the science fiction dream of simply talking to machines into reality. The more you know about voice recognition, or even just the more you think about it, the more incredible Siri is today. Siri has to take what you say, send it around the world to Apple servers, interpret it, and send an answer back in just a fraction of a second. If only it could do it more consistently. Ask Siri on your Apple Watch to set an alarm for 6 p.m., and it will commonly complain, saying that there isn't an alarm for 6 p.m., which is why you are trying to set one in the first place, isn't it? If Apple just fixed the little things, the marvel of technology would be so much better. The glitches are just the start of it, said James Vincent in TheVerge.com. When Apple arrived a decade ago, it had an unbeatable wow factor. Since then, though, it's been matched or beaten repeatedly. Siri is inferior to Google Assistant on mobile and outmaneuvered by Amazon's Alexa in the home. Meanwhile, as it squandered its first-mover advantage, Apple insisted on having Siri push its other products. Apple uses Siri to herd people back to its own inferior apps, like a shepherd directing sheep off a cliff face. When I ask for directions, Siri prompts me to reinstall Apple Maps. And when I try to send an email, I use Outlook instead of Apple's mail program. All I get is, I can't do that. Siri can still be your go-to voice assistant, said Jennifer Pattison Tui, also in TheVerge.com, just as long as you know its strengths and limitations. On the iPhone, Siri's lagginess is legendary, but use it to control your home devices, lights, television, speakers, and its snappiness will floor you. Whatever you think of Siri, there's one big group whose lives have been truly transformed by voice assistants, said Abrar Al-Hithi in CNET.com. People living with disabilities who can't easily get around or use a keyboard and screen. The actor Susan Bennett was the original voice of Siri. The big surprise for her when she revealed herself in 2013 was the tons of mail from people who were blind or had other disabilities saying they used Siri all the time. Apple replaced Bennett's voice in 2013, but you can still hear it now in public service ads advocating for greater web access for the disabled. And we'll flip over to the Talking Points page, starting with climate, anxiety, and gloom among the young. A growing number of young people are suffering from climate anxiety, said Kate Yoder in Grist.org, and are sinking into a gloomy outlook about the future. with extreme heat, wildfires, drought, storms, and flooding visible all over the globe. A recent global survey of 10,000 people ages 16 to 25 in 10 countries, including the U.S., detected widespread psychological distress over climate change. Three-quarters of respondents to the poll called the future frightening. 56% agreed that with the claim that humanity is doomed. A startling 39% said that climate change has made them hesitant to have children. This birth strike isn't primarily driven by fears of adding to humanity's carbon footprint, said Liza Featherstone in NewRepublic.com. Young people in both rich and poor nations just don't want to inflict the climate crisis on their kids. That's a sign of pain and distress, and a call for help. What has happened to us, asked Rod Dreher in TheAmericanConservative.com. Previous generations faced existential threats such as two world wars, the Depression, and the nuclear standoff of the Cold War, but they started families anyway. What have we lost that the people of my father's generation and older generations had that gave them resilience? The willingness of two-fifths of today's young people to surrender hope in the future is evidence of a deep spiritual impoverishment. Throughout history, said Bjorn Lomborg in the Wall Street Journal, innovation, technological progress, and wealth creation have saved humanity from much greater dangers. It's what will help us now. I could certainly understand why young people are pessimistic, said Noah Smith in noopinion.substack.com. The world's chance of fulfilling the Paris Agreement pledge to keep warming down to 1.5 degrees centigrade now looks very slim indeed. And most Americans polled in 2019 by the Washington Post opposed climate change proposals that would raise their taxes or costs. But even if the public doesn't take the climate problem seriously enough, scientists and engineers do. Their rapid development of cheap solar, wind, and other green energy sources is starting to make decarbonization both possible and an attractive economic prospect. So let's not succumb to pessimism and despair. Climate change is beatable, and in coming decades, human ingenuity and determination can and will save our planet. National divorce. Should red and blue split? Americans are so bitterly divided that many are willing to break up the country, said Henry Olson in the Washington Post. A new poll by the University of Virginia's Center for Politics found that 41% of Biden voters and 52% of Trump voters believe their political opponents are so dangerous that blue or red states should secede from the Union to form their own country. The poll found that Americans in both parties have come to view the other party with fear and contempt. The idea of a national divorce in which the U.S. would be split into freedom-loving heartland and a bi-coastal progressive utopia, already being proposed in the MAGA-friendly Claremont Institute, may seem far-fetched. But history has shown that countries can break apart if enough people want it. It's a fantasy that can never work, said Carol Markowitz in the New York Post. Think of the millions of conservative voters in blue states. In New York, Trump won 3.2 million votes in 2020, more than five times the number of people living in deep red Wyoming. Would conservatives surrender these people to the divorce, or do they move elsewhere? Who would get swing states like Michigan, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin? And would red states like Florida and Texas, worried about an influx of Democrats seeking warmer weather and lower taxes, give ideological tests before letting someone in? Some progressives may be happy to let conservatives go. But count me out, said Ed Kilgore in nymag.com. It would hardly be safe to live next to a carbon-mad country devoted to denying climate change. And I could never accept the accelerated subjugation of women and people of color in a new adjacent red America. With a whiff of civil war in the air, Americans need a reality check, said David French. in the dispatch.com. Our divisions are not as deep as we might believe. The University of Virginia poll, for example, revealed that most Trump voters support most aspects of Biden's human infrastructure plan. The real problem is the malice and misinformation perpetrated by social media and partisan websites and networks, which leave well-meaning Americans believing they have nothing in common with the other tribe and that people who disagree with them are hell-bent on stealing elections and destroying the country. American radicalism has now filtered down into the ranks of the normal folks. Here's one short note. Americans in rural counties are currently dying of COVID at more than double the rate of city dwellers. Low vaccination rates, high rates of spread, and poor overall health are to blame, say health officials. We've turned many rural communities into kill boxes, said Alan Morgan of the National Rural Health Association. And we'll finish the hour with a quote from author and journalist Hunter S. Thompson, who famously said, "When the going gets weird, the weird turn pro." And with that, we have run out of time for today's episode of the week. I hope you've enjoyed it. Be sure to listen again next time. This is Fred Woodward reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's program is generously underwritten by W.G. Alexander. At W.G. Alexander & Associates, they take pride in providing clients with the best legal counsel by concentrating on elder law, asset protection, and estate planning. They can be contacted at 919-256-7000. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The week is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any questions or comments, please give us a call, 919-832-5138. And thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.